If you like Chardonnay, you'll like this episode. Then again, if you don't like Chardonnay, you'll still like this episode. Huh? How can that be? Simple. The Chardonnay flavor spectrum runs from Butterball style to Lemon Laser Water. And it all depends on whether the winemaker employs the holy trinity of white winemaking or not. Confused? Intrigued? Listen up. This is the Inside Wine Podcast. I'm Joe Janisch, a certified specialist of wine and wine industry professional since 1996, giving you insider tips to make the right wine decisions. Today, our guest is Christopher Dooley, also known as Chris Dooley, also known as Topher Dooley. And Chris has been a sommelier for, it's been about 10 years now, Chris?
Yeah, about 10 years now. Wow.
Yeah, and at some of the top restaurants in the country, in the biggest cities, in Cincinnati and Boston, most recently in New York at 11 Madison Park. And not just your experience, but you also have an advanced certification from the Court of Master Sommeliers. And now, if the listener has never seen the movie Somm, or they just don't understand what that certification means, maybe you could just explain why someone should listen to you about wine.
Oh, sure. And it's funny. I remember right before I left for Boston is when the Somm documentary came out. And so I remember seeing that and be like, oh man, that's Brian McClintic. That's Dustin Wilson. You know, all these people that I ended up getting to meet through one way or another, or, you know, through that. But the kind of path, and I kind of got in a bit early, like just before the sommelier craze really took off, which I think that documentary definitely helped kick off. And taking the, you know, you have these four different levels. You have introductory, certified, advanced, and master. And they've made it fairly challenging to get accepted because there is so much interest and so many people that want to take these exams. I passed my advanced exam in 2015 in March. And it has, it's over the course of a few days. You have a blind tasting component where you have to correctly identify three whites and three reds in 25 minutes, which I think is always the most fun because you're basically giving a monologue and you're playing detective and you're trying to kind of stay out of your own way and listen to yourself without trying to jump to conclusions. There's a theory portion, kind of a written theory where, you know, it's just kind of back in school, taking a test. Which is fun because it's not just, you know, what is certain legal designations or what have you, but some real world application where you're doing costing things out and working on how to correctly run a program, which I think is really important. This sometimes gets overlooked. It's not as glamorous, but it's definitely, I think, one of the most important things. And then finally is service. Where you take care of a few different tables and they kind of grill you and you kind of go through the motions. There's some props, but not, maybe it's not complete. And so you get to play a part and kind of enjoy that. And that's what I've always enjoyed is kind of the service element, is talking to people and just kind of getting to know them and having, building up that comfortability and earning that kind of trust.
Right. And it sounds like you know a little bit about wine after all this.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Yeah, a little bit, right? But please tell me you don't smell tennis ball can in any of the wines you ever sniff.
So I'm pretty sure that tasting note has gotten retired.
Good.
It's funny. It's, you know, ever since that documentary came out, that's what everyone talks about. And it's like, you know, whenever you're in a tasting, there's, I don't want to say you roll your eyes, but it's like, oh, yeah, we know where that tasting note came from. And it's funny because I have one that I used to do with kind of richer styles of Chardonnay in my tasting group in Boston was pineapple upside down cake or underripe pineapple core were my two like go-to tasting notes. And I could feel everyone at the table being like, okay, here we go again. So it's one of those that I've personally tried to retire myself.
Good. Let's keep it dead. So you mentioned Chardonnay and I'm glad you did because I want to talk with you about Chardonnay. I think that the listener may or may not realize that there's more to Chardonnay than just the California versions that I don't want to say they get a bad rap, but I think that Chardonnay kind of gets cornered into this little butterscotch, sweet, ripe fruit, oaky, vanilla, spicy. And there's a lot more to the grape. And you're one of the people that I know in the industry that knows Chardonnay inside and out. And that's why I wanted to talk to you today and kind of explain to the listener all the different faces of Chardonnay. And if you are one of those Chardonnay people, how you can kind of like branch out and find other versions of it that you might like just as much or even better.
Oh, absolutely. So Chardonnay, I think, is the most versatile grape on the planet, and it is by far my most favorite. I like to play a game where you talk to people. It's like, if you could drink one grape and that's it for the rest of your life, what would it be? And I think Chardonnay is a strong contender for that, especially if you're into white wine, because not only can it be made into sparkling, there's some incredible champagne Blanc de Blanc, 100% Chardonnays, or, you know, there's some fun sparkling wines from England that's really kind of trendy and kind of on the rise right now. And even here in the United States, there's some really great domestic sparkling that's being made from Chardonnay. But then you go into the still category where you're right, people kind of pigeonhole it to this big, rich kind of butterball style. And while that is definitely a style of Chardonnay that's popular, but there's so much more to it where you can have these really lean, bright, crisp styles that don't just taste like, I like to call it lemon laser water, where it's just like so underripe, it's so painful and kind of punishing, where they can keep this brightness while giving it complexity and character without ripping the enamel off your teeth. So right. I think that's really important, because there's people, it's the pendulum swings, right? You have those rich styles and somebody's like, well, I'm going to make the opposite of that. And they kind of just make lemon laser water. And, you know, there's a trajectory there. But I think what I enjoy most about it is that there is such a variety of how to produce the wine, starting in the vineyard or into the winery, and all these different winemaking practices that you can use to help explore the terroir. You can explore the winemaker's personality and vision. There's just a lot to play with that you don't necessarily see with other white wine grapes. My favorite thing is I call it the holy trinity of white winemaking. And it's a malolactic fermentation, lees aging, and barrel. And with Chardonnay, you see some variation of all three a lot. And you can't say that for many other grapes. And so that's something to me where you can just dive in and find that really lean, bright, crisp, summery wine, or you can have that that big, rich style of Chardonnay. It's like, you know, like a hug, you know, like a warm hug.
I like warm hugs.
I do too, you know?
So help me out, because there are so many people who, you know, especially here in the United States, they just order their wine or they purchase their wine based on the varietal, which is kind of like the way most Americans have been trained. How do you help someone who's like, all right, I want a Chardonnay, but you're really not sure what to do with that question, being a geek like me or you, like, because we're like, well, there's like 50 different variations of Chardonnay. So, you know, if the person said, yeah, well, I like a Chardonnay, what would be your first question for that person to kind of like point them to the right wine that they would like? Or maybe even it's not even a Chardonnay, even though they say that they like a Chardonnay, what kind of questions would you ask them so that you can help them make the right selection?
Yeah. So one of my favorite things to do is like, well, what have you had recently that you've enjoyed? And it doesn't even necessarily have to be Chardonnay, just a bottle of wine that you've liked and that maybe you want something similar. Like, you know, if like, oh yeah, I had some California Chardonnay recently. It's like, okay, great. Well, we can, do you remember being like bright and crisp or that kind of rich and in style? And then do you want to try something from kind of left field, somewhere where you wouldn't think it would come from? You know, I think what's great is earning that informality and earning that trust is that you can kind of take them on a journey. You know, I don't think many people recall like Patagonia for Chardonnay, but there's some really delicious wines being made from that region, from Rio Negro, that's like outstanding. But you're not going to get there by just like picking it off a list or off a shelf in a retail store. You need to talk to somebody. And so kind of just getting a picture of what they're looking for, how adventurous they want to be, I think is important as well. Because you're like, oh yeah, oh, you like California Chardonnay? Well, here's a Chablis. It's like a French style. And it's like, you know, maybe that's not the exact analog to use, but it can be in the right circumstance. And so I think just diving in and finding out what they've drank in the past that they've enjoyed and how they want to depart from that. Or if they want something very similar, can go right down the middle of that way.
Oh, hold on a second. You said Chablis was Chardonnay. I thought it was Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh my. Okay. So one of my favorite things to do, and I don't think it's subversive, but I think in many of the restaurants that I've worked in, we offer pairings, long format tasting menu. Pairings are generally thought about the way to go. And so I'll take the temperature of the table and, you know, okay, great, you're going pairings, or anything you like don't like. And often I'll get, oh, I hate Chardonnay. I hate big oaky Chardonnay. It's like, okay, cool. Or just straight Chardonnay. And it's like, okay, you know, that's cool. And so I always like to sneak in a Chardonnay somehow. And it's usually, and it's white Burgundy, because since it doesn't say it on the label, I can at least get away with that.
Sneaky.
Yeah, sneaky. And so I always like check in and be like, oh, what'd you think of this Chablis? And they're like, oh, wow, this is really fantastic. And, you know, I think it has to be, it's not a gotcha moment, because I don't want them to think that I'm trying to trick them throughout the meal. But being like, you know, this is a different expression of Chardonnay that presents itself in a very different style that complements the food and, you know, at least broadens some horizons. And, you know, some people are like, nope, still don't like it. And I'm like, all right, great, let me bring something back. But that's something that I've always enjoyed doing, just to, because I think there's so much press out there. And for the longest time, you know, you think, and this is a tired example, but in, oh gosh, now I can't even think of the movie, Sideways, of course, you know, the Merlot, the great Merlot comment that like basically tanked the industry.
Yes.
And I mean, and is only just now starting to recover over the last few years and just getting Merlot into people's glasses and like, oh wait, this is really good.
They'll drink Bordeaux though.
Right, exactly. It's like, oh, exactly. Yeah, right. And so just being able to get it in the glass, I think, is the most important thing. And it's like, whether you like it or you don't, that's fine. But I think the curiosity, I think, is important.
Yeah. Of course, I knew that Chablis was Chardonnay. I've been in the wine business long enough to know that. But I just wanted to bring that up because, to your point, most people don't realize that Chablis is actually Chardonnay. And you mentioned your Holy Trinity. Maybe we could take those two expressions of Chardonnay, the Chardonnay from California, let's say a Chardonnay from Napa versus one from Sonoma versus one from Burgundy.
Okay.
How could you like play around with your Holy Trinity and explain it so that people can kind of get an understanding of what the taste profiles might be like?
Sure. Yeah. We'll kind of paint with a broad stroke here, because, you know, there's always so many producers that are making things differently. But I think in Napa Valley, I think what's great is that Chardonnay can handle sunshine and can handle ripeness. And when you have a warmer region like Napa Valley, the Chardonnay gets riper naturally. And with that allows you to play with a lot of different things, because if it has this ripeness, it can also take on a lot of different winemaking, whether it is barrel fermentation or aging in new oak. There's a reason you don't see that in cooler regions, say like Chablis, for example, because if you put new oak on just any Chablis, there's a good chance that that oak is going to dominate the wine, and that's all you're going to taste. So the great thing about Napa is that you can play with those things and kind of turn it up to 11. And so you have those barrel spices, the vanilla, the cinnamon, and nutmeg. And then you can also play with lees, which is going to, you know, the spent yeast cells, and kind of turn that around in the wine and stir those things. And you get this biscuity, toasty kind of brioche aroma. And then malolactic fermentation, which is a mouthful.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, you're taking this malic acid, those bright tart acids that you find in, like, you know, say green apple, and changing it into the acids that you would find in like milk or cream. And you have this kind of richer, kind of softer style. And so what's great is it's not all or nothing. There's a sliding scale. And so I think for this example, you're going to put Napa on that side where you can turn all those knobs up.
Okay.
Whereas in Sonoma, you're going to be a little closer to the coast by and large, especially if you're on the, you know, the extreme Sonoma coast, where you're not going to have that sort of ripeness. And so your aging program, your winemaking program, you have to be judicious in how you use some of those techniques, because it can easily overpower the wine. And so you're not getting those tropical aromas and flavors and stone fruit flavors that you would in Napa. And I think with white wine, there's a range of fruit flavors. And in my head, it's citrus, orchard fruit, stone fruit, and then tropical as you're going from kind of the cooler to warmer regions. So with Sonoma, you're kind of, now you're touching a little more into your orchard fruit and stone fruit. You're kind of in that middle ground. And so you're seeing like maybe a little less oak, depending, and a little less overall in that. And then you're in Burgundy, where it's cooler and it's a different kind of philosophy overall, in that you're not making Chardonnay, you're making Meursault, you're making Pouligny Montrachet, you're making Pouilly Fouissé. And so that kind of informs, and there's much more winemaking history in Burgundy. So there are definitely radicals there, but there's a continuing of that lifeline of Chardonnay of that region. And so I think with those, you're seeing more savory characteristics overall in Burgundy. And a lot of them play with another winemaking technique with reduction. And you see this in domestically as well, but reduction is something, and I won't get too complicated with it because you can go down the rabbit hole there, but it's basically that like flinty matchstick aroma. And much like the other three techniques I was talking about, you can go overboard and you can have too much reduction. You have too much oak, you have too much lees, and it's all about balance. And I think having those things in sync with the fruit that you're given and the ripeness that you have is really important. So the flavors that you kind of see in, say, in Pouligny Montrachet, like there's like white button mushroom and kind of this rocky kind of white rock character, this chalky limestone minerality to it. And there's also oak, and there's just this really like harmonious balance that I find that's really seductive and alluring.
So, you know, Burgundy can definitely get complicated. There's all different areas and villages and everything else. So if you were talking to someone and they said, oh, I like the Napa style of Chardonnay, I like kind of like that oaky, that overripe, but I want to try something from Burgundy, is there like a particular village, particular area that you'd say, start here because it's a similar type of ripeness, a similar type of mallow, similar, like where would you direct them?
Oh, absolutely. So it's I was very lucky to work at 11 Madison Park to have the breadth of wine that we have. I think we have 20 pages of Chardonnay.
Wow.
Something like that.
It's a little overwhelming.
Yeah. So it's a perfect opportunity for somebody who's maybe not as comfortable or familiar with Burgundy, because it can kind of be a minefield, that there are some producers that are just like that laser, like bright, crispy style. And then those rich, warm, big styles as well within the same village. So given your example, somebody was drinking Napa style Chardonnay, I would immediately take them to Meursault, which is tricky because there's a handful of producers that do the exact opposite of what we traditionally think of as Meursault. So it's best to go with a guide.
Right.
But I think Meursault, you get this like nutty, it's always known for being a little fuller bodied, a little more rich. So I think that's a great analog to go into, especially if somebody's coming from, you know, something richer in Napa, a good way to go and dip your toe in the water of Burgundy.
Okay. And let's expand a little bit.
Sure.
If you like a Napa, again, I'm going to stick with Napa for now, Napa Chardonnay, and you want to explore into other areas of the world, maybe New Zealand, maybe South America, are you going to find similar styles in any of those countries or other countries where there might be a similarity?
Absolutely. And I think that's the great thing about Chardonnay, is that it can be grown basically everywhere.
Yeah.
And if you can plant grapes, somebody's at least tried to make Chardonnay from there, which is fantastic. And you can see it kind of all over the world. There's some really terrific stuff coming from New Zealand. There's some great stuff coming from Australia, South America, South Africa. And so it's interesting to see those wines and how they're produced and seeing what their inspirations are. And it's tough for those kinds of regions, because so often when you taste those wines, like, oh yeah, no, this is kind of like our Pouligny Montrachet. And it's tough for a region that is emerging to have its own identity, because Burgundy is kind of this monolith of winemaking and tradition. And so often at the beginning, people will compare themselves to Burgundy and then start to create their own identity after that. I've seen that kind of time and time again, especially, you know, in New Zealand, you know, say with Pinot Noir to kind of switch grapes. But I think a lot of times people will immediately give a Burgundy analog first. But yeah, you can definitely find different styles of Chardonnay all over the world. And I think that's what's really exciting, is that no matter where you are, you can find Chardonnay.
Yeah, it's exciting, but at the same time, it gets complicated and it can be frustrating. So If I'm going to stick with the Napa thing, just because it's an easy place to start. And I think it's a place where a lot of people, they have in their head what that tastes like. if our listener wants to explore beyond that Napa Chardonnay and they're willing to go on the internet and do a little bit of Googling here and there and look up some things about the different wines, what are the key things that they should look at as far as like climate, as far as, you know, whatever else, barrels, like what are some of the key components that they should be researching if they want to explore beyond and not be disappointed when they find out that the Chardonnay that they ordered from Argentina tastes nothing like the one they remember from Napa and it's a disappointment. How do you avoid that?
Sure. And what's great is that a lot of producers, I remember years ago when I was getting into wine and, you know, it was hard to find tech sheets.
Right.
And trying to find the technical data. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to find out exactly what the total acidity is or anything like that. But just knowing how the wine was made, you know, you look at things like barrel fermentation and barrel aging, I think is incredibly important because that gives a picture of one, how much money they're putting into the wine. Barrels are expensive, especially new French oak. You know, you're looking at $1,500 to $1,600 a barrel for that. And so it's an investment. And so if you're putting your wine into new oak, you're going to have riper wines by and large, and because it can take on those flavors. And so looking at those barrel regimens, if it's, you know, 9 months, 12 months or longer, you're going to have more of those, like that cinnamon, nutmeg, vanilla kind of flavor to it. And ideally some of the riper fruit to balance that out.
Right. And the type of oak matters too, right? Where it's from.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you can have, when I talk about like new French oak, I'm talking about small barrels, 225 liter mostly is kind of the like barrique. You can also have large 1,000 liter casks that it just sits in. And it's not going to impart necessarily oak flavor. And it's something that facilitates oxygen exchange, which just allows the wine to kind of come into contact with some oxygen. You're going to get a little more oxidative quality. And that's kind of a way to go with that. And then another aging vessel is stainless steel and fermentation vessel. And so when you see stainless steel, I don't want to call it lemon laser water, but that's kind of like where your starting point is. And that's something that's, you're going to, if you see this wine is aged in stainless, this Chardonnay was aged in stainless steel, mostly it's going to be that really bright, crispy style of Chardonnay. Whereas if you see this wine was aged in new French oak or even large oak, you're going to have a broader wine overall.
And is there a big difference between French oak and American oak?
There is. So let's see. There's not a whole lot of American oak being used in Chardonnay that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But they give different flavors. I think there's, you know, coconut, that suntan lotion, that A1 steak sauce kind of flavors you kind of get from American oak. And you see it a lot in maybe like Zinfandel or Rioja is very classic for American oak. Shiraz as well from Australia. But I haven't run into too many Chardonnays that use American oak. I'd be curious to see how Chardonnay handles it and see what those flavors do, because that's a combination that I have not come across, at least in recent memory.
All right, good. Now, you mentioned the stainless steel as well. If you have a Chardonnay from stainless steel, it's probably not going to have that vanilla. But then there's that other step in the winemaking process that you mentioned, the malolactic fermentation. And we're all going to say it 7 times until we get it right. Malolactic fermentation. That kind of can add some things to a wine, and that can be done with either a barrel-aged wine or stainless steel wine. What kind of malolactic details are people going to look for with the malo?
Yeah. And I think it's important that you mentioned like with stainless steel, because like I said, with those really bright, like aggressive style of acids, it's you're only accentuating that with stainless steel. So a way to kind of temper that and bring it into balance is to use some malolactic fermentation. And as I said before, it can be a range. So you don't need to go 100%. You can go halfway or however you'd like to go. But it's a great way to kind of take off that harsh edge and kind of bring it into harmony that way. And so you see more of that, just a creamier mouthfeel. Like you can smell it. There's popcorn is always the classic buttered popcorn is something that people get from that quite often. And it's definitely there in those wines, and it allows to add a dimension to the wine as well as kind of just rounding off those sharp edges.
Okay. So if you see malolactic fermentation or just shortened as malo, then you're going to get the creamy buttery.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, great. So now we get to the fun part.
Oh boy.
When you have different types of Chardonnays, how do you pair them with food?
Oh, sure. Let's see. So I think what I would love to do, and we've done something like this with like champagne at 11 Madison Park, but doing an entire tasting menu with Chardonnay, that's how diverse I think the wines can be.
Oh, cool.
And that's something that's always been a fun thought experiment for me. So trying to find the perfect progression. And so I think a way to start the meal is champagne. And that's always my favorite. Blanc de Blanc from anywhere in the world, but specifically champagne is kind of my favorite. So you can start with that, you know, especially if you're doing something that needs some cleansing, caviar. A lot of dinners or kind of long format tasting menus will have caviar there. So having something to cleanse that and match that kind of saltiness of it is really crucial. And then you can kind of move on into those salads, the antipasti, kind of those beginning dishes. And so those generally, you know, will not have a whole lot of cream, or they're just lighter dishes overall. So you can play with something that's like an unoaked Chardonnay. You can play with something that doesn't see any new French oak, or, you know, say like Chablis or something on the more like extremes where you're in the Sonoma coast or New Zealand, where you can have something to kind of play with that. And then after that, you're into your seafood categories, you know, buttered lobster and Chardonnay and rich Chardonnay are, you know, is a match made in heaven. You know, it's that the chef's kiss. So having like looking at how those seafoods are prepared, and I think you can kind of do this in a few different ways, but I think shellfish and Chardonnay just go hand in hand. And especially if you have like a butter sauce, you're in oaked Chardonnay territory. And so that, I think that just is happiness and is one of my favorites next to champagne and caviar. And you can kind of go up the route and keep turning those wines up to 11 as you get into your, you know, vegetarian entrees. You can definitely play it with meats. You know, I think pork and chicken are great meats to play with in terms of Chardonnay. And what's fun is that they even make sweet Chardonnay. You know, in Burgenland, there's a producer that makes some terrific sweet wine that you can do with fruit-based desserts. And it's just outstanding that you have this wide range and versatility of one singular grape. So I think now after having saying it all out, I want to plan a dinner and do just that.
I think you should. I think this should be something you do, is plan out Chardonnay dinners for people. I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
It's funny. Someone once told me, and actually it was one of my wine teachers, Kevin Zarelli. He said that when I have a big steak, big juicy ribeye steak, I don't think of something red. I think of an oaky Chardonnay. And I was like, yeah, what? How does that work? Can you explain how that would work?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of my favorite things to do is, you know, as soon as like, oh, I have the beef. What do you recommend? I was like, oh, I would recommend the Meursault. And they look at me, they're like, a white wine? And so I'm like, oh, yeah. And generally they're like, no, I want red wine. But I'll bring out like a half glass and be like, hey, just try it because it's fun. And it's, you know, it's all about exploring and broadening horizons. But I think you have a big oaky Chardonnay, you have a steak that's been grilled. So you have this like smoky element, this kind of like caramelization of the meat. And so I think that pairs really well with something that has malolactic. So it has the weight and the power there. Then you have the oak that kind of plays with that caramelization. And, you know, there can be smoke in the wine. And I think having a white wine with that is really fun, and it kind of flips the script a little bit while being successful. And it's not just a, haha, we're trying something different, we're doing opposite day, but it's actually something that can be very successful.
See, it's funny. Like I heard that probably 20 years ago, and to this day, I've never tried it because I just like, no, he's just like trying shock value. There's no way that's going to work.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. All right. So... You told us a lot about Chardonnay today. This is really,
it's true. Yeah.
This is really amazing. So, thank you. So what would you say to the person who actually says they do not like Chardonnay other than Chablis? Are there any other areas of the world or styles of Chardonnay where, you know, if someone says, well, I'm someone who likes Sauvignon Blanc, I'm someone who enjoys Vermentino or something like that, how would you point them to a style or a region that has a Chardonnay that they might enjoy?
For me, probably one of the most interesting regions in the world right now is Oregon. And there's a lot of different styles there, as is everywhere. But I think there's a tension in Sauvignon Blanc. There's attention in a lot of things, but for giving your example, it's like you like to have that kind of like brightness, the little zesty quality. And Oregon being a little cooler climate than, say, California allows for that to really blossom and shine. And so going to somewhere like that, you know, and again, we'll paint with a broad brush that those producers up there don't necessarily have the candy land that is Napa Valley in terms of, you know, financial backing. And so they don't have these new oak barrels. And so you're just seeing how they can do it with what they're given and just the fruit and kind of playing around with that. And so you see these wines that have just a little more tension and nervy kind of energy to it that I think can really bring somebody into the Chardonnay fold without kind of hitting them overhead with like an oak mallet, which is delicious. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, but sometimes that's a little more than what people have bargained for.
Yeah, it's funny. If baseball bats were made out of oak, I would use that as the image, but.
Oh, it's a missed opportunity. Just call Louisville Slugger up.
This was really good, Chris. I really appreciate it. Any parting thoughts on Chardonnay? Because you clearly love it. Any parting thoughts are for those who still are not convinced after about 35 minutes of talking Chardonnay?
Sure. If you've made it this long. So I think what's great is if you're unsure and you're not quite clear on where to go, is to go to your local bottle shop, go to a trusted restaurant and make friends with the sommelier or with the wine shop person and just like ask. And be honest. I think that's one of my favorite things is that like when people are just like straight up honest with me and like, hey, this is what I want to pay. I don't like this. I kind of want to figure out why I don't like it, or I just want to explore it a little more. And what do you got? And I think just being honest is one of I beg for that, because usually we can know if somebody is leading us on or saying things they're not fully aware of what they mean, which is, you know, fine. Because we're translators as well. And so just, you know, having that trust and asking for help. So exploring those different regions, I think, are really fun. Because one, you get to try to go outside of the box. And you can go to places that are maybe not necessarily as fashionable, like Puy Fuissé used to be very big and then kind of had a little resurgence a few years ago. But I think is a region that you can discover and have some really delightful Chardonnays that you wouldn't necessarily have otherwise.
Yeah, and I'll second that and add a little bit of Mâcon Village, one of my favorites.
Yes.
One of my real favorites.
Yeah, the value there is terrific.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. For like between, you know, $11, $12, you can get a bottle of wine that tastes like it should be about 30 or 40. It's amazing.
Yeah, punches above its weight class for sure.
So toward the end of helping people who need a little more help and understanding Chardonnay or any other wines, where can people find you online?
Sure. You can find me on Instagram at DooleySom, D-O-O-L-E-Y. You can follow me on Twitter at Chris Dooley to find my ramblings there. But yeah, I think those are the best ways to contact me. If you have any questions about Chardonnay, I'd be more than happy, as you can tell, to talk your ear off given the opportunity.
Yeah. And not just Chardonnay. You know a lot about wine in general. So let's not cut yourself short.
I'll do it all.
Maybe you can set up a Chardonnay dinner with him.
There we go. Anyone wants to do that, I'd be more than happy to make that happen.
All right, great. We'll have all those details in the show notes. Thanks so much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this discussion on Chardonnay. Check the show notes for more about Chris, also known as Topher. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Inside Wine Podcast so you can get the next episode the moment it is published, which will be in about 2 weeks. In the meantime, for more about Chardonnay and all things wine, visit wine365.com. And remember, wine is food, it comes from a place, enjoy it responsibly.